Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Has time run out for King Harbor Hospital? Hello again, I'm Omar Nalini, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. We're playing Russian roulette with everybody in the emergency room. That's the way Supervisor Gloria Molina describes LA County's King Harbor Hospital, formerly called King Drew. The federal government is threatening to withdraw half the budget because patients are in danger. The last straw may be videotape of the hospital staff ignoring a writhing woman dying on the floor. What would the closure of King Harbor mean for healthcare countywide? Would unionized workers who failed professional tests be handed off to other county facilities? On Reporter's Notebook, surviving on food stamps, first here's the news. We're only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Closing down LA County's King Harbor Hospital, formerly called King Drew, once seemed unthinkable. But yesterday, Los Angeles County supervisors asked the health department to draw up contingency plans. After years of substandard care and needless deaths, the federal government has threatened to withdraw half of its budget. After pleas for delay and promises to retrain the staff, more than 40% of licensed vocational nurses failed to pass tests on their professional skills. The incident that best dramatizes conditions at King Harbor, though, is videotape of a woman writhing on the floor while hospital staff ignore her. Edith Isabel Rodriguez was buried yesterday in Tehachapi. Charles Ornstein has been writing about King Harbor for the Los Angeles Times. And Charles, always good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again, Warren.
For those of our listeners who haven't seen the videotape or read about it, just describe that awful scene with Edith Isabel Rodriguez.
Well, Warren, I have not seen the videotape, but it's been described to me in pretty intricate detail. It shows Mrs. Rodriguez plunging forward from her wheelchair while she was in the emergency room lobby at King Harbor Hospital in the early morning hours of May 9th. And she, after plunging forward from her wheelchair, she was writhing in pain on the linoleum floor for about 45 minutes. All the while, staffers from the hospital looked on, fellow patients looked on, a janitor cleaned around her and didn't ask her how she was, but it was clear that she looked like she was in pain, and it was nobody bothered to help her.
And two people called 911.
That's right. Her boyfriend called 911. When he found her in this condition, he tried to alert nurses and staffers, and they wouldn't help him. So he went outside the hospital and dialed 911 and begged. The dispatcher said, "My wife is dying." And they said, "What do you mean dying?" And they said, "She's vomiting blood." And the dispatcher was found this really hard to believe and said, "You need to alert a doctor or a nurse. Paramedics can't pick you up because you're already at a hospital." So that was one call. And then 8 minutes later, a bystander called. And the bystander was a female bystander, apparently another patient at the hospital. And she was even more adamant. She spoke English, whereas the boyfriend did not. And she said, "You know, this woman is being ignored." And the dispatcher grew increasingly testy and was telling her, "This is not an emergency. This is not an emergency." And she said, "This is an emergency." And the dispatcher said, "This is not a life-threatening emergency." And it was really hostile to her, to the point that at the end of the conversation, she said, "May God strike you down for the way you've acted."
And then what happened was that the police ran a computer check on Mrs. Rodriguez, found she had a no-bail warrant for her arrest, and took her to a squad car?
They were in the process of taking her to a squad car to arrest her, and in the process she became unresponsive, and she was brought back into the emergency room where she was pronounced dead.
How much of an impact do you think that had on the supervisors as they made their decision yesterday to ask for contingency plans for closing down the hospital?
Well, I'm not quite sure, Warren. I think what the case does and the release of the audio tapes, which can be found on our website, latimes.com, I think what the release of sound does is it lets people hear for the first time the agony and the pain associated with some of the problems in care at King Drew. It's one thing to read about them in the newspaper, but to actually hear these agonizing phone calls really crystallizes it for folks.
Now, the chief medical officer has now been replaced. There was also, as I indicated earlier, promises that the staff would be retrained, this because the federal government was putting on so much pressure. What's happened?
Well, Warren, this is about the eighth time that the County Health Department has promised to retrain staff. They promised to retrain staff in the fall of 2003, early 2004, later in 2004, and 2005, and 2006. And then we learned just yesterday that 40% of licensed nurses, 40% of certified nursing assistants were not able to pass basic competency tests. This is really troublesome, as you indicated, because these folks were tested on these, and these were the staff that were chosen to stay at this hospital. Remember, hundreds of staff were transferred out of this hospital because they were deemed, to be not the best staffers.
If the hospital were to be closed, what would happen to the staffers that are there now?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important, from my perspective, and I've said this for more than 3 years now, I don't think that my position is not to advocate that the hospital should be closed. I think this hospital provides a vital service to this community, and it would be hard for the community to get access to care elsewhere. But if this were to shut down, the staffers at King Harbor would be cascaded to other county facilities and would displace workers at other county hospitals because they would have to maintain their, positions within the county system based on seniority.
Seniority based on union contracts.
That's right.
Okay. How long now does the health department have to come up with contingency plans?
Well, the health department has 2 weeks to come up with contingency plans, and in the meantime, they have 23 days to come up with a plan for correcting the deficiencies, the serious deficiencies, which are putting patients in immediate jeopardy of harm in King Drew's emergency room. So they have quite a bit of work to do.
And we don't know, obviously, what sort of plans they will come up with. How firm were the supervisors, or did they appear to be, in terms of their intention or apparent intention to close the hospital?
Well, I don't think that I think that every supervisor, this is their last wish. I mean, they do not want to close this hospital. They want to do everything they can not to close this hospital. But I think reality is creeping up on them that, next month will mark the absolute final inspection, according to federal officials. And if they fail, their federal funding goes away. And supervisors have said if that happens, they will have no choice but to close the hospital. But one thing, Warren, I think that, is worth it for your listeners to know is that, the health department has not provided much information in the way of public information. Speaking to the constituencies served by this hospital, or even speaking, to the press, they've issued mostly statements which haven't answered some very fundamental questions that we've asked about the care provided at the hospital, and I think that the public is entitled to know answers to.
Okay, we asked the health department to be on our program today. They declined our invitation. Charles Ornstein with the Los Angeles Times, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Michael Rembus is president and CEO of the Sentinella Freeman Health System that operates hospitals in Inglewood and in the Marina. The ones in Inglewood being very close to the King Harbor Hospital. Michael Rembus, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
What would the consequences be on your hospitals and on other hospitals in Los Angeles County if King Harbor were to be shut down?
Well, if that was to ever happen, I think the consequences would not be good for the communities we serve. There's long delays in all of our emergency rooms. I think the whole system is stressed right now, and I think any further closure or downsizing of MLK will result in patients having to travel long distances, having problems with access for many patients. Many patients have difficulty with transportation. And the existing facilities in Los Angeles are very crowded, especially emergency rooms. And I think you'll see longer waits, delays, and problems with access of care.
Many of the private hospitals are in financial trouble. It's difficult to make money on hospitals. Will they be affected as well as the county systems?
No question. So many of the patients we all serve are either Medi-Cal or indigent, and MLK takes far more than their fair share. And those will be dispersed to other hospitals, which would further put other hospitals in financial distress.
And these are patients that those hospitals cannot refuse, is that right?
They cannot, and I don't think they would, but it would have financial impact that's negative on their bottom line and their ability to provide care for the patients in their community.
I don't want to ask you to comment on what's going on at another hospital, but how difficult is it as a hospital administrator to change the culture of an institution like that?
Extremely difficult. I think that's the greatest challenge we all have. Cultures are established over many years, sometimes decades. And to change the culture, if I had an answer for that, I'd be extremely successful, and we all would be. It's hard. There's no one thing that you can do to change the culture. It requires a real assessment of the staff, the motivation, the incentives, everything that makes up the working environment creates the culture. And it's almost impossible to change quickly, and it's very difficult to find the successful factors that will change it.
Talking with Mike Rembus, the president and CEO of the Sentinella Freeman Health System, remind our listeners what we just heard from Charles Ornstein. They now have 23 days to change the culture at the hospital we're talking about. Ralph DeLibero is an orthopedic surgeon. He's also president of the Los Angeles County Medical Association. And Dr. Libero, good to have you with us.
Gosh, thanks, Warren. This is one horrible nightmare. And, of course, this scenario is totally unexcusable. And it's right to point a finger, but we must be very careful. We must be very sure when we're pointing our finger, we point it at the root cause of the problem. The root cause of the problem that exists, and we talked about this before, Warren, about emergency cares and closure of emergency facilities throughout Los Angeles County. The root cause of the problem is that Los Angeles County, in this corridor, which probably extends from Alameda Street now since the closure of Memorial Hospital all the way to the 405 freeway, the root cause of the problem is the lack of a health safety net in this area, a problem which has existed since 1965 and continues to exist. There's no good medical home for the people of the area. Of course, we have IMTALA in the emergency room in the hospital. That means that any patient that goes into an emergency room gets stabilized for whatever the problem may be. But there's nothing before IMTALA, and there's nothing after IMTALA. After a patient is seen in an emergency room and needs follow-up care, there's really no place for that patient to go. There's no specialty service to accept that patient. And before IMTALA is even more extremely important, because if we could treat all of these patients with a health safety net, a good medical home where they can get their services where they live, then there won't be this pressure on the emergency rooms throughout the county, which is seen mostly in the corridor, and we won't see these long waits, the delay in care, lack of access, etc., which is just a horrible, horrible thing. It's unexcusable, but I think we really have to get to the root cause of it.
Let me ask you this. Given how long this has been going on, Charles Ornstein told us at least since 2003.
I said 1965.
It's been going on a lot longer than that. So here we have Mike Rembus saying that changing the culture of a hospital is very difficult. They have 23 days left. Should the hospital, or is it almost inevitable that the hospital will be closed down?
You're not going to change the total culture of a hospital in 23 days. I mean, let's face it, it makes no sense you're going to do that in 23 days.
Well, do you have to close it down?
But you can't close the hospital down because the people are desperately in need of services. And if you have to change the culture, you have to start with the health safety net in the area. We have to form private-public collaborative partnerships. We have to get these people taken care of, where they live, where they work, maybe clinics at the schools for the kids, that sort of thing. And it has to be developed. A good program has to be put forth in this area, and that's how you change the culture. You start at the base, at the root cause of it. You change the culture there, and then instead of looking at the end result of a horrible thing that has happened, we will be able to correct those horrible things from a root cause problem.
Dr. Ralph DeLibero, the president of the Los Angeles County Medical Association, back to Mike Rembus at Sentinella Freeman Health Systems. Do you think that private hospitals such as yours would want to engage in the kind of up-from-the-ground restructuring that Dr. Libero is talking about?
Are you asking if we would want to do the same type of restructuring?
Sure.
It's very difficult to do, but I think every hospital needs to reevaluate and try to rebuild and improve the culture. It's just very hard in 23 days to make the kind of change that's being implied that needs to occur at MLK.
Constance Rice is a civil rights attorney based in Los Angeles, a very familiar voice on our program, co-director of the Advancement Project Policy and Legal Action Group. She's been an attorney representing all kinds of different interests and very much a public citizen here in this vicinity. And Constance Rice, it's always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
You've been looking for a long time at the situation at what used to be King Drew, now King Harbor. And here we have a situation where, again, in 23 days, it is promised that deficiencies of an extraordinary nature will be corrected. Do you think that the hospital ought to be kept open?
I think it might have to be kept open. That might not be the relevant question at this point. We've got a county that does what it usually does, which is to govern by catastrophe. The systems that we provide for the poor don't seem to get any attention until there's catastrophic failure. And as your previous speakers, who have far more expertise than I do in medical administration, have indicated, this has been 30 years in the making. And Warren, I don't know whether you remember, there were two letters in the appendices of the report that the former Surgeon General, Dr. Satcher, did for the first evaluation of the failure at King Drew. And you'll, I think you remember those two letters from nurses. These were two highly competent nurses who are very professional, were thought very highly of, and they wrote letters about 2.5 years after the opening of King Drew, and in those letters they said, please help us. We are professionals. We are trying to carry out the highest standards of care, but we're being undermined at every point because our colleagues don't have the training they need. And Warren, what happened to those two women? They got run out. That was the beginning of a culture that tolerated failure and incompetence. And then it got wrapped in symbolism and tribalism and protectionism, and they lost the focus on the mission of delivering health care, and it became a jobs program to a great deal. Now, that does not mean that there haven't been terrific people come through King Drew. There's some wonderful doctors. Some of them are friends of mine. There are some wonderful nurses who have left. There are terrific people who have gone through this institution. Many of the residents have been wonderful. But when you have a baseline framework, when you're in that hospital, it's the whistleblowers who get, the messenger who gets shot, so it's not a problem-solving culture. And when you have problem after problem, year after year, mount, it becomes almost sacrilege to even raise the alarm.
When you talk about symbolism and tribalism and protectionism, are you talking about politics?
Oh, it's surrounded in politics. One of the reasons I had friends who were attorneys for King Drew, who tried to tell the hospital, you can't run your residency programs in a way that makes non-African Americans feel like they're not included or discriminated against. A lot of people tried to help. But anybody who raised issues about that said that, no, we have to defend. This is a symbol of what we got from the Watts riot. It just became the politics of preserving a symbol, a very important symbol, a very understandable symbol. But when you get veer off the mission to the politics of symbolism, you often end up protecting a culture of loyalty rather than a culture of problem-solving, rewarding whistleblowers, trying to raise the standards of performance. And it then becomes wrapped in the politics to the point where folks can't even see that folks are dying. And you just, it ends up distorting the lens through which you can see this problem. I feel kind of bad for folks at this point because there's been so much work put into it. They have made improvements. The training has gotten a lot better. But as one of the previous speakers said, you can't turn around 30 years of this trajectory in 23 days or even 24 months. It really does take a parallel restructuring. You almost have to recreate that institution over again because even good people who go into that hospital end up getting pulled down. I mean, you can't look at those tapes or hear the 911 calls. How do you mop around a woman who's vomiting blood? It's almost like watching the Rodney King tape. All those officers were used to that. Not a single one of them looked at each other like, what's going on? When you see that, you know that the culture, that's the norm. And we also have to keep in mind, and I think other speakers, if the county had been on the phone, they would have raised the point, look, we've been operating in a MASH unit environment for a long time. We have let the county safety net deteriorate to the point where you put so much pressure on an institution like King Drew that even in the best of circumstances, it wasn't going to deliver. That's not to excuse what happened here. There's nothing that excuses what happened.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there. Again, the Watts riots were in 1965, as Dr. DiLibero pointed out. The hospital was founded in 1972 to serve that community, and the problems have been getting worse ever since. We will see what happens. Again, the county has, I think, less now than 23 days to report back with contingency plans. Will it be left open because it has to be? Can it be improved? All those issues as yet to be decided. Constance Rice, thanks to you. Thanks to Ralph DiLibero of the County Medical Association, Michael Rembus of Sentinella Freeman Health Systems, and Charles Ornstein of the Los Angeles Times. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
More Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A. Millions of Americans try to survive on the weekly allotment of food stamps, which averages $21 worth of groceries a week. To dramatize what that means, some members of Congress took what they called the Food Stamp Challenge. One of those was Democrat Barbara Lee. She is from the East San Francisco Bay Area. Her district includes Oakland and Berkeley. Congresswoman Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What is the Food Stamp Challenge?
Sure. Well, you know, what is taking place now here in Washington, D.C. is that the Farm Bill is up for reauthorization. And very few people know that the food stamp provisions are included in the Farm Bill. And also nutrition, education, funds for community farms, for farmers, you know, for fruits and vegetables, for school programs and what have you. And so what we're trying to do as co-chair of the Progressive Caucus and first vice chair of the Congressional Black Caucus is to raise awareness about the issues around food stamps. One, $21 a week. That's $3 a day. How in the world can anyone live on $3 a day?
Let me ask you to answer your own questions. How did you live on $3 a day?
Well, I must say it was very difficult, but having lived on food stamps for many years when I was raising two children, I probably could figure it out, you know, better than a lot of people, although it's been years. And so for me, coming back into it was very much of a challenge. I actually went to the grocery store and bought probably about $12 or $13 worth of food on last Tuesday, which was World Hunger Day, which I kicked it off on. And I bought two cans of beans, one can of peas, six chicken legs, they were 99 cents a pound, grits, and some bananas and some crackers. And what, of course, first came to my attention and awareness was the canned vegetables and beans. High sodium content. And, of course, we know the relationship between high sodium and hypertension. And when you look at the health effects of eating like that, carbs, you know, grits, bread, it's very clear how people with no money who are poor, low income, really are predisposed to all of these very terrible diseases. You look at childhood diabetes, it's off the scale right now. And so what I had to do to try to get a balanced meal, I had to pick and choose. For instance, I went to the counter with an apple and two bananas. Well, I couldn't afford all three, so I ended up with two bananas because that was a lot less expensive than the apple. I wanted some oatmeal and some grits, but I had to choose between the two because if I had bought both, I would have gone over my budget. So I chose the grits because I figured I could be, they were a bit more versatile. And I bought crackers, and what happened was after a day or so, I started saying, wait a minute, this food's going to run out. So I started counting crackers and putting them in bags to bring with me to work. And all along, though, the point is people are living like this every day.
So the food stamp challenge for you was to try to get by on that $21 a week, the average of food stamp allotment. The challenge for people who are trying to exist on that allotment is to try to be healthy.
Well, yes, and I worry about it and extremely concerned about how in the world we in the wealthiest country in the world would allow people or require people on food stamps to live off of $3 a day.
You trying to get an increase in that?
Oh, yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
How much of an increase?
And also, well, we don't know what the formula, quite frankly, is going to be now. I would like to see $20, $30 or more. But also the eligibility issue. Only 65% of those eligible are actually enrolled in food stamps. And why? And again, we're trying to dramatize this. The stigma is a large factor. And I remember when I was on food stamps, it was a terrible thing to be on food stamps, and the stigma associated with that is a real provides for a disincentive to enroll.
Do most people on food stamps rely entirely on those, or is it a supplement to other ways that they can get money and buy food?
Well, of course, some people actually are. You know, the working poor is growing in our country. Some people are working minimum wage jobs. Some people are not working. Some have TANF. You know, welfare, general assistance. You know, so some have income coming in, minimal income, but then, again, $3 a day, $21 a week. takes away a lot of that income. And then the other thing that I'm trying to call to the public's attention is that formerly incarcerated individuals for drug offenses are for a lifetime ineligible for food stamps. Now, in California, those who are leaving prison are given $200, and they cannot use any of that money to purchase a food stamp if they had been incarcerated for a drug felony.
We're out of time. I'm sorry for that. 26 million Americans on food stamps, 2.5 million of them in California. Half of those are children. Barbara Lee, very good to talk with you, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Which Way LA, produced tonight by Dan Konecki and Christian Bordahl, technical director Phoebe Zimmerman. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.